working with Bradley Cooper on A Star Is Born is that you're always thinking of how to make the film better. Spike Lee does the same thing. Darren Aronofsky's contemplating the screenplay. They're always there trying to make the film better. As cinematographers, we have to be ready for improvisation or else we're not going to make the film better.
Hi, and welcome to Open, Filmmakers Talk. This is Edgar Dubrovsky. In this episode, I talk to Matthew Libatique, ASC, renowned cinematographer who shot Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, Native Son, Mother, Straight Outta Compton, and A Star Is Born. This episode was recorded in June 2020. The Black Lives Matter movement took off. The protests were ongoing in the US as well as other countries. So this became a very important background to our conversation. In this episode, I decided to talk to Matty about his early years, the formation years, moving from East Coast to West, as well as his lesser discussed projects. For example, Rashid Johnson's Native Son, Alex Prager's short films, and Spike Lee's Mike Tyson's stand-up.
Hi, Matty.
Hey, Edgar, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Good morning, I guess, 10:30.
Well, I should be up earlier than this, to be honest with you.
Good. To speak specifically about the race issue in the industry and our countries, in a way, both US and Latvia, where I come from, and London, where I live currently, and also your less discussed projects. So I want to start with an easy one. Do you feel American?
That's an easy one? I don't know. If that's easy, what's the rest of this thing going to be like, man? Of course, I do. I actually do feel American. I mean, I am. Growing up, I felt it was confusing. You know, I'm a first-generation Filipino-American. My parents emigrated here 2 years before I was born. Growing up, I didn't have a lot of interaction with other people. It was family and friends, and all I remember is get-togethers with other Filipino people, right? But in school, I was always called Chinese, you know, growing up in the 70s in the East Coast. It's like the Filipinos didn't really exist. And every Asian culture was lumped into a label of being Chinese. You know, I was too young to understand, to be offended by it, to be quite honest. I just almost felt normal, to be honest. So
when did it stop being normal? When did you feel, okay, that's not me. I'm not Chinese to start with.
Well, it started as you got older, you know, and education and forming thought and then understanding and sort of experiences. You know, when you're a child, you're spending a lot of time with your parents. When you're a child, you're spending a lot of time with family. And then you venture off into school and then you see friends and then you build relationships, right? You know, when I was about 14, we moved to California from the East Coast. And it was a whole different dynamic. I was exposed to difference. We moved into a neighborhood that was predominantly Latino, Mexican, and Black. So all of a sudden, coming from New York and New Jersey, where I spent my childhood, I was surrounded more by family and friends that were Filipino, but then I was always in school, it was always white people. So when I got here, all of a sudden I was surrounded by, that's where I really started to realize that my opinion started to form. My experiences started to form.
When was that? So what year are we talking about when you moved?
We're talking about the early 80s.
And what was the thought process for those maybe who don't know? So you moved from New York to LA, and why do you end up in minorities neighborhood? Is it because kind of white people neighborhood are unaffordable? Are there legislations preventing you to go there? What was the situation then?
I can't say it's legislation, but it was economic. It's strictly economic. It's where can you afford to live? I think a large part of racism in the country has to do with economic and social inequality that's been established for years and years, decades.
Housing is a big part of it, I guess, as well, the way geography.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And how much your parents made. I used to think we were middle class, but when I stopped to think about how much my parents actually made collectively to support the household, we weren't, by today's standards, that would just definitely be below middle class. And I appreciate it. Actually, I'm happy that I did. You know, I learned a lot. You know, the first day in California, I think it was, I think I started in the middle of eighth grade here. And I sat next to a kid who was a Chicano American. He was reading a book and he was almost done with it. It was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I asked him what he was reading and he gave it to me. He said, I'm done with it. And he gave it to me. And I still have that book to this day, Autobiography of Malcolm X. you know, he subsequently, the next year when we went to freshman year of high school, he was murdered in a gang shooting on his birthday. His name was Fernie Baruman. And I'll never forget that experience of meeting this man. I only knew him for a year. I mean, this kid, you know, I only knew him for a year. And he was caught up in a gang lifestyle. And he was also somebody who educated himself. So he was my first introduction to somebody who's politicizing themselves and learning about things of race.
Can you explain to those who might be kind of a bit oblivious maybe to how the gang style lifestyle works in US as well? For example, this kid you mentioned, how did he end up kind of in the gangs and subsequently shot? How does that happen when you do live in these maybe neighborhoods which are more dangerous?
I can't speak to it. I wasn't in a gang. I was surrounded by them where I was growing up. This is Ontario, California, which is about 40 minutes east of Los Angeles. And, you know, I can't speak to that. I can only speak to what I've seen. You know, I saw, you know, you, and it's a tough thing to do because how I grew up and from what I know, you don't speak about what they do because out of respect and also that's their thing. But all I can say is, you know, you don't want to divulge any of the secrets. You know, I'm not a journalist. Mm-hmm. And I do have a lingering respect for why they're in gangs. Not that from a criminal standpoint, but just as a social construct of them being in gangs. And, you know, we've all seen films. We've all heard about gangs. Gangs have actually, in a way, exited our thought because people, you know, whether it's subsided or not, it's just not in the public consciousness. But it has a lot to do, to me, with social inequality. But gangs have existed before we were conscious of this current problem. You know, I mean, it existed with the previous minorities, the Italians and the Irish and the people who were disenfranchised by the country and the government.
Because in the end, it is kind of even like a wording of ganging up, I guess, is part of just surviving as a minority if you're not represented anywhere, partially yes. To, I guess, coming together into a group to protect yourself as well, I guess.
I mean, there's an economic standpoint, there's a business model, and there's a social model to it all. And, you know, I can't demonize them like the press demonized them in the 80s. I also can't glorify them like popular culture glorified them in the 80s. But I understand and I respect the concept of it. You know, if you transition to all the criticisms in the last 2 weeks of the people who were looting stores, it's like trying to come to an understanding about what is happening. You need to step outside of yourself if you don't understand and understand that there's a root to a problem. And you can't take yourself and your experiences as a person who hasn't had to deal with social inequality or economic inequality, and then transpose your thoughts and your experiences into a place where you're putting them on someone else who's had a completely different experience in their lives. It's extremely important now when you go online today and you go on Instagram, for example, or Facebook or Twitter, there's so much anger and there's so much opinion. But when they talk about change, like where is that change going to take place? It's not just with police reform. It could be even deeper than that. And do people want to go there? That's the question. And when they're speaking back to going back to the gang thing, do people want to go there because they don't understand it? Do they really want to dig deep? Do they have the presence of mind to actually dig deep to why that exists?
I guess the only solution is to listen and I guess ask questions.
Listen, learn. We have time. Most of us are in lockdown. And in the film business, like you and I, we have time to do that. And in some ways, maybe it's a blessing for social change.
Do you remember the first film you've seen?
I think it was Shampoo, Warren Beatty. I remember seeing that film and all I could remember is hair, which I think might have an actual
impact, you know, on your
bearing on the rest of my life.
Because I wanted to ask you about that point, which really interests me as yourself coming from a minority background, is when do you realize that most of people in the mainstream films and TV are not representative of yourself? Do you remember having that moment, like, I don't really recognize myself in a lot of these characters? Or does the kid's brain sort of adjust early on and filter it out?
Well, look, growing up, you know, I had immigrant parents who really wanted to assimilate into American culture. And I think that you follow your parents' lead. It never bothered me. I remember seeing Star Wars in 1977 and waiting in line to get into the movie theater. And, you know, I think I was attracted as a child to films that stepped outside of social, you know, that were more in allegory. And it took you to a place where you're identified. And I, you know who I identified with in Star Wars, I remember this and I still remember this, is I didn't identify with any of the characters except Chewbacca. So, you know, that's just, you know, I think about that. Oh, Ed Lachman and Jimmy Mack are watching. I see yeah, that I right saw, there. Two of my saw, favorite people in the entire world.
The entire I just saw world. That. I'm them. Trying not to, to be nervous. I'm just as if I'm just chatting to Mattia there.
This is what this whole thing is. It's the one good thing about Facebook is that they
it's great. Instagram. It's great to see that people are watching and commenting as well. In regards to the racial demographics of a film set, and did you feel going through the ranks of budgets, you know, starting from indies was Darren Aronofsky, I guess, and then ending at the top league with multi-million Iron Man productions, for example. Did you see that it changes as you go from lower budget to higher budget? What's the situation, in your opinion, when you started maybe and currently as well, in terms of Black filmmakers, Black crew as well?
I would be dishonest if I said there was a lack of cultural diversity and diversity in general. I started being a DP in 1995. And have I seen changes from then to now? Of course. And the diversity on crews is the biggest thing. You know, when I got out of the American Film Institute, my first objective was to become a music video cinematographer. I actually worked with Ed Lachman as an assistant cameraman, as a loader and a second AC. I learned a great deal from him about being sort of bridging the gap between craftsman and artist. And then I finally left because I don't know if Ed remembers this, but I left a show called Touch that he did with Paul Schrader for a music video with Ice-T. So I started my career shooting hip hop and rap videos in California. And there was diversity in there. You know, I've been fortunate to see sort of the growth of diversity. And then you go into the recent years, the last 5-6 years of the Academy and the Academy Awards, and you see the push for diversity and the push to get people of color into the Academy. I've seen that happen. That's all great. But I think, you know, it's been a very difficult 2 weeks of understanding that none of that's enough. None of that's enough. Because for all the people who have opportunity, there are so many people who have suffered through legislation that has made their education worthless. And subsequently, there's going to be a social price to pay.
Why do you think nothing changed? So 1992, so that's just under 30 years ago. So it's a whole new generation. So someone who was born on a day when riots started would be 32 right now. Like, it's literally, I was born basically when it was happening,
right,
behind Iron Curtain. What's at the core issue, in your opinion? Is it people in power not doing enough?
Well, the motivation in America, like, I can only speak for America. Right? And maybe because of globalization, it speaks to other countries.
Yeah, definitely.
But legislation hides behind the concept of capitalism and economic growth, right? So we've polarized our society, hiding behind certain things like the economic growth and the prosperity of people. But there isn't a prosperity of people. If anything, the hiding behind the concept of capitalism, it's almost you're demonized in this country for speaking against capitalism, because capitalism is a construct that we were built on. This country's been built on, right? It goes again to the concept of thinking outside of yourself to understand, like, maybe we have to reinvest some thought into what are the choices we've made that have actually disenfranchised people because of our need to have economic growth, and step back, which means, and this is a Bernie Sanders concept, this is a Elizabeth Warren concept, it's a progressive concept. It's not spreading the wealth. It's maybe the 1% has to have a little bit less and then a little bit more for everybody else, and you can regrow the middle class. And that doesn't come through tax cuts for the rich. You know, always reminds me of the concept of looting. It's like they loot, we loot. And so before you criticize a bunch of people going into a shoe store and taking shoes, think about what has been done to them year after year after year through legislation.
Matty, thank you. When was the last time you got a script and you were not happy with the way certain races were represented in that script? When you read it and you were like, no. Does it still happen? Does it happen often? Or you haven't received anything like that for 20 years?
I mean, I don't want to pinpoint anybody, but I haven't experienced that lately. I have not. People are conscious. You know, we're our business is born equal parts business, equal parts art. And perhaps business maybe, you know, supersedes the art part of it. But I have to say, I remember, you know, in the early 90s when I was in school with at the American Film Institute, Darren would call almost everything racist. And this is Darren Aronofsky would be, that's racist. And he would point something out. I was like, that's racist. That's racist. And he was, you know, he is to this day socially conscious in that regard. Like, we grew up listening to hip hop, listening to the KRS-One and Public Enemy, Chuck D, and listening to their words. And they're prophesizing things. And it was a life-changing moment, you know.
And to put it in context, his point of view, would that be minority? Like, or would most of the film grads, film school people be sort of more progressive than an average person on the street? Like, or was he kind of a standout for those ideas in those times?
It was a cultural thing in terms of our popular cultural thing. It was predominant in our time when we were young that, you know, look, Do the Right Thing was the film that made me a cinematographer. It's a film that made me a filmmaker. Like I've said many times, it made me feel like a person like myself could actually make films, and that could be a choice in my life to actually dedicate everything to. Darren had similar leanings. You know, we talk about those things, and there was an activist mentality to it that we could change the world by making films about with social commentary. And Fike has, you know, to his absolute credit, has never let go of that, which is why he's one of our greatest American directors. You know, because he recognizes, even before my time of consciousness, he's recognized that disparity, and he's found ways to tell stories that point towards that disparity.
Yeah, Spike always fascinated me for that, as throughout his whole filmography. Why do you think is that most do let go of their social conscience, and Spike doesn't? What's inside Spike that doesn't let him go?
Maybe you'd have to ask him that. You know, I mean, it's a drive. Sometimes it's a driving force. When we're lucky enough to find something that drives us day to day, then you hold on to that thing. That, because it's truth, I guess. It's the truth that you hold on to. And some people, they have activist leanings. And this is the big problem with what everybody's saying today. When people actually get angry at other people, and people get offended because maybe they said something wrong, or they didn't, you know, they have a post that they put up, and maybe that's tone deaf to people and activists that are dealing with today's problems, today's specific problem. You know, it's not truth to them because they're just saying what the party line that they've told themselves. It's like, I'm not racist. I don't look at the color of people's skin. Maybe that's just a party line, but do they believe it? Is it their truth, really? Or is it the thing to say? What has to happen is it has to become your truth, or it's not going to last. And Spike Lee is an example of, you know, his work. It's his truth, you know, and it's as simple as that. And go back, and you have to re-examine yourself. You got to step outside of yourself, and you got to maybe relearn concepts.
True. Yeah, because I guess that's the difference between sort of the issue of Vogue, that it lasts usually half a year, and then Vogue jumps onto the yet another issue without actually solving the previous issue or staying long enough to even analyze it. You can't, in half a year, there's not enough time to read all the books on the subject and watch all the films shot. And that's what really, if I may share my view as well.
Please.
I'm kind of lucky enough to come from the Iron Curtain side and then come to London, which is almost 15 years ago now. But I'm also lucky to have traveled US as well for certain projects and documentaries as well. And that's my big advice to people who have money, go to New York or LA. Of course, yes, see that. But if you have money for a second trip, take a car and drive through America from New York to LA.
Yeah.
You'll see the actual America, because New York and LA is America, but it's at the most developed pinnacles of it, where everything is obviously, there's an amplitude of everything. But if you drive through all the little places and stay and have a dinner in some of the diners and pop into barbershops, have your haircut and speak to a barber there, and you will find out much more, I think, than just watching one side of news or the other side of news. It's all, I think, a bit more complex, yeah, than just going to these two cities.
It's true. And, you know, when you interact with somebody, I remember going to a country and the first thing, when I go to Europe, the first thing I do, if I'm in a small city that's not Paris or Barcelona or Madrid, and you're in a small town, what do you talk about? You talk about football.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. You just go, you know, if you're in Poland, you talk about Lewandowski. It's just like you just bring up something that's common. Like, that's our common language.
And it's easy. You can judge a lot from what who people support and what their beliefs are. I think it's a new religion of sorts, because everywhere we fly, and I'm sure it happens to you as well, that it's watched everywhere. It's very kind of diverse. You can
have
Premier League top level stuff in all the different European leagues. And then there's tiny leagues everywhere. I remember being in Vietnam and there was a match, I think, Vietnam versus maybe Sri Lanka. I can't remember. But it was like the local cup to then qualify to maybe one day go to the World Cup. And everyone was watching. Like, literally every single person on the street was watching. So every face was illuminated green and blue. And it was this beautiful sight. And people kind of, yes, this is the reality of it. Or the same happened in Kenya and Tanzania when I was shooting. There was a interesting conversation I had with a cab driver there that they only support clubs which have red in their logo because they feel it's the color of power. So they love Liverpool and Man U and so on. So they have their kind of local why is it strong? It's amazing. And suddenly you're like, oh, interesting point. Like, you know, you live here and you have your beliefs. So yeah, travel and go away from just the most popular cities.
I met Johnny Marr one day through a friend, and he was a big Man U fan. And I had to be like, no, I'm a Man U fan, you know, because like typically in America, when you talk about Champions League, everybody's a Man U or a Liverpool fan.
Yeah. Like these big exports.
Or Arsenal.
Arsenal. Or Chelsea. And then they have the camps of like
people. Right.
But
what I love is when people get into the other leagues or the smaller clubs. The smaller clubs are actually interesting.
There's a certain beauty of that. That's true. Yeah. So find common grounds, and that's going to kick off your discussion. I think to finish the discussion on the issues, I want to ask you one last question, and then I want to ask you some questions about the projects we kind of pre-discussed a bit. Have you ever been afraid for your life?
You know, I'm a person who grew up during the Cold War. We grew up under the umbrella of the possibility of nuclear war. So as a child, which everything gets dramatized when you're small. Yeah, there was that first time. And then in my 20s, there was the AIDS epidemic. So there was that feeling. I feel like I've been fortunate in my life to be able to travel the world through my profession in a global society as a global citizen. And then recent years, things have shifted towards a more authoritarian, populist, fascist sort of governments. So, a few times. And there's specific times that I do not want to share on a Facebook platform. But there have been times.
So the first project I want to have a discussion with you is The Native Son. So Rashid Johnson's piece. And he's an artist. So that's an interesting one that it's not specifically a filmmaker artist, even kind of a fine art artist. Based on the Richard Wright book, which kind of steered the populace even when it came out. I read the essay by Baldwin where he kind of disagrees with the book. So there's a lot of discussion already in that material. When you got the script and from the moment you started prepping and shooting, was there enough time to prep something of this complexity? How much time did you have to brew it?
I think I met Rashid over the phone maybe a month and a half before, perhaps 2 months. But I didn't really have, I had 3 weeks of prep initially. It was a very low budget film.
Oh, wow.
By the time I arrived in Cleveland where we shot it for Chicago, we had 3 weeks. It was probably the most effective 3 weeks I've ever experience in a prep, because Rashid was keen on understanding how each scene would work. And the thing about Rashid is that he is actually a filmmaker. Like he made films as part of his art. Like he's a creative person that goes beyond the work he creates. And there's a cinematic quality to what he does. And he'll go from something as abstract as Anxious Man, which is one of his, if not his most notable work, to films about dance and movement. And he would shoot 16mm in the most beautiful light possible. So there's a taste in the
art. And he shot that himself? So that was...
Yeah, yeah. So he is a filmmaker, you know. And he was in transition to me. What I love about Rashid is he was in transition from somebody who would create work to be interpreted to going into a medium that had to be more literal so that you didn't have to interpret it. And that's where I really appreciate him and appreciate the experience of making that film.
And I guess he struck good middle ground with that film, because I had really long discussion with my girlfriend, for example, after we watched it. We watched it like last week. There's a lot to debate. There's a lot to discuss on views. And yeah, it's beautiful work. Still, I think it has that sort of in-between feeling. It doesn't literally tell you, okay, this is a good guy, this is a bad guy. This is white is bad, black is good, whatever. Like, it leaves you those interpretations. So I guess partially he succeeded there. And
well, I mean, I have to say that what he succeeded in is taking a concept that was written when the book came out, and drawing a straight line to modern society and seeing how things have not changed that much. And the black experience has evolved, but hasn't changed that much. And again, the way I look at it, it's due to a systemic problem of economic and social inequality. That's the kind of point of modernizing something that was written in the 40s, you know. I have to say, my one trepidation about even making the film is I had an experience previous to this making a film about a novel, Everything is Illuminated, that wasn't well received, because literary people like to hold the film next to the novel and the experience of reading it, that, you know, perhaps, in both cases, they were lower budget films. How can you possibly, even if it's a bigger budget, how can you possibly predict the mind of every individual that read the book
and what felt purpose? Something? I never understood. What's the purpose? To prove, yes, it's exactly how I imagined. You should be happy. You should be happy if it's not exactly how you imagined. So you're like, oh, great. I didn't think about that. I didn't think that this is the line the director can draw. Otherwise, what's the point of sitting in an echo chamber?
You're speaking to the concept of people stepping outside of themselves and learning something new.
I really enjoyed it, and it's a beautiful poetic piece, and also but interesting. So 3 weeks, so how much did he come with to you? Was there some form of visual book by then, if you have 3 weeks to develop it? What was done by Rashid
on our initial call? This has never happened before. We literally had the same exact reference point. Sometimes like a director brings in a reference point and you have a reference point after reading the screenplay. But when I met Rashid, we had the same exact reference point visually, which was Roy De Caraba, the work of Roy De Caraba.
The photographer, right?
The photographer. Mm-hmm. And perhaps his inspiration for Roy De Caraba was different than mine. But the point is that we could zero in on the same thing really quickly. And that had never happened to me before. You know, I've had common ground with many, many directors. And part of being a cinematographer is actually being open to how every director is and being open to ideas enough to be able to accept them and actually interpret them quickly.
So speed does matter still, right? Because there is not much time to prep.
Speed matters all the time. It's something that you come to. To be successful as a cinematographer with speed is about your experiences. It's about your experiences not only in life, but also in work. It's also about how much you have studied outside of a project, the possibilities and potentials and commonalities between culture and life. So you develop these things and you become a person. You know, the one thing that's beautiful about cinematography is that we get to work with so many people. directors don't get to work with as many people. We get to work with a lot of different people. And if we're really lucky, and I feel lucky, I get to work with people of different cultures and different upbringings and different socioeconomic paths. You know, to do that is a benefit for me. And I could bring all that to the table when I'm trying to interpret what the director is saying. But to have somebody all of a sudden in the first call talk about the same exact artist, the same exact person, that 3 weeks of prep, we skipped over the, let me just say, I skipped over having to understand his visual reference.
Do you feel it's getting worse in terms of prep being cut even on bigger budget jobs, that you don't really have enough proper time to prep? Comparing, for example, when you started with Darren, would you be like talking for months about some of your first work together?
Darren and I, you know, is a special circumstance, and I put him in a different category because we've known each other for so long. But we do spend a lot of time preparing. Preparation with him is probably, I spend more time prepping on films with him because he demands it. He needs it. It's part of his collaborative process. You know, we come from the AFI, which is, you know, if I had to say at the American Film Institute, the one edict is collaboration. You know, that's the thing that they hammer into every class. And I've talked to other people from other classes before me and after me at the American Film Institute, which I, you know, that was an eon ago. I graduated in 92, 93 from the American Film Institute. And people who've come after me and people who've come before me have talked about the concept of collaboration. But I spent a lot of time prepping with him. I don't get as much prep on with other people. Mm-hmm. The fact is, when you're prepping a movie, as a cinematographer, it's like, how much of the director's attention do you actually have? A lot of directors are pulled in different directions from the producerial side and from the casting side and from the studio side that perhaps you're not getting as much time. So you end up sitting around, left to your own thoughts. And yes, that's a luxury, but what good is it if the person you're working with isn't available to you? You know what I mean?
Is there a solution to it? Do you think that there's a way to solve that?
Yeah. You know, what I've done is I sit in meetings that I've, you would think the cinematographer doesn't have anything to do with. What I've learned to do is if they're having a costume meeting, I ask if I can go. If they're having a meeting with the art department, I ask if I can go, just to be an observer. Information is key. You know, learning is key and understanding is key. And then perhaps it doesn't speak necessarily directly to what you have to do as a cinematographer, as a craftsperson.
Yeah, at least you feel in the loop as well, I guess.
Well, it gives you insight on the directorial process and that person's process. Look, everybody, every director preps a film a different way. Every director thinks a different way. Some want a shot list, some want a previs, some want to do both. And as a cinematographer, you have to be ready to do anything. But you have to be malleable to that process. And if you need something also, the more time you spend with the director, the more comfortable you're going to be, especially if you don't know them, to be able to ask them or present the problem to them. Because in my experience, production always avoids asking them the hard question because it's based on money and they're afraid that the director is going to be defensive because it's a money conversation. But as a cinematographer, we're almost a gap, a bridge between the concerns, the practical concerns, and the creative concerns. Because I don't know why that fucking happened. I don't want to be a bridge between practical concerns and creative concerns, but you know, cinematography has become that for me.
Is there some sort of fear to ask questions, basically?
I don't have fear. I don't have fear.
But it's like, why no one else at that meeting does it? Is it just no one wants to offend each other by just asking, hey, this is not enough. This location is shit.
Let's think about being a director. Think about stepping outside of yourself and being in your head, how hard that job is to be a director, to be somebody who's responsible for not only the cinematography or the look of the movie, but they're also responsible for creating a flow between their cast, creating a tone between all departments. And then also having to deal with the political side of the, you know, the high-end studio conversations that they have to hear. And then have to communicate some of the stupid things they hear to people like myself or yourself. That's a big thing. I think we need to understand that that's a big thing. And we have to have sympathy for it and help them.
It's so true. It's part DPing, part psychotherapy, usually on the shoot days as well.
Right. And we do that. We do the same thing with our crews. We do the same thing with our crews. That's... When they're unhappy because of the conditions, we could either go to the production and help their conditions. Maybe we do that, or we can go to the higher ups, or we go to them and say, just, you know, this is the situation we're in. This is what I've learned based on the conversations that I've had. Mm-hmm. We all have to just deal with it. Or it's like you go to the higher ups and people who have decision making and money decision power and just say, we're not going to be able to do this. You should talk to the director directly. I'm not going to talk to him. You talk to him and tell him he can't do it.
And then I guess you've shot it pretty quickly as well, talking about Native Son. It wasn't like a long job, right? About a month to shoot or something, I read? Something along those lines.
It was a very short shoot. I think it was 25 days or 20 something. The thing is, we photoboarded the whole thing. I mean, that's the thing. In 3 weeks of prep, I would have never photoboarded a film with any other director I've ever worked with but Rashid. You know, why is that? One, I think it's because it's an independent film and he didn't have those burdens of dealing with the politics of how the film was set up and what the ask was and what was needed and what the expectation was. It's like he was left to his own devices because it was an independent film. So he could actually dedicate time to photo board the film, which was amazing. And that went a long way to understanding what we're going to do on any given day. Did we stick to it all the time? No. We augmented it. But the preparation for any film is having a plan to go into every scene, but having the more you're prepared, the more you could improvise. And that's a key.
Do you feel that freedom? You talk about that he had and you to storyboard, to photo board it. Do you feel it goes eventually past a certain number of dollars? So when you reach a certain budget, the risks are kind of higher. They don't have time, blah, blah, blah. So you just don't even have time and to do it or something. Like, why does it disappear, that freedom to create?
Because we have expectations from our financiers. As simple as that. I think that you get into a
usually
situation,
that means kind of rounded corners. Usually that means easy solutions.
No, it becomes less time to spend working on a scene. The director's attention is brought into other aspects of making the film that are important to the 10 producers, but not so relevant for the people who have to execute the goddamn movie.
I think what's going to change massively for the generation, like my brother is 8 years younger and he's also kind of breaking slowly into the industry, is also they think differently about contacting people. Like even me, like I just kind of messaged you and then we chatted and agreed to do this. So there's this slightly barrier broken to actually talk to people you would like to talk and see what their opinion is. And you can ask, you know, like Deacon's had his forum for some time and so on. So people can like ask very specific questions about.
Yeah, that's, I know. I mean, it's incredible. Like I've listened to people's talks and I've learned from them. And like, usually our lives are so busy, we don't have time to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because you asked me a question. I'm not trying to forget.
Yeah, remember. Yeah. It was a Zoom. It was on Zoom. Zeiss, I think it was.
It was a Zeiss call that you asked a very interesting question about how social media informs your references or something like that. And it's a really interesting question, which is why, you know, I wanted to do this.
Thank God I asked that one. But yeah, it fascinates me because I think it's also, like you mentioned it, if it's, you know, capitalist in an American way to some extent, if that issue is even discussed, you know, behind American doors or West Europe, talking about, say, Black Lives Matter movement, it's massively discussed. Like for few weeks nonstop in all the kind of Russian DP circles and WhatsApp groups, there's a lot of discussions and people have different views, but it has never been discussed. It's suddenly like, people like, oh, okay, this is my view. And someone says, well, my view is this. You know, I've been to those countries. I've seen this. So suddenly world is like so much smaller. Even when I mentioned to some colleagues of mine who speak Russian, obviously they know you, you know, and they watch some of your Zooms and Insta, like you've been doing these last weeks as well. It's massive kind of world film school and world exchange of ideas, I think, as well. And it's never been like that. I want to ask you about working with another artist, Alex Prager, the photographer who then moved into filming. I think I saw her in the comments somewhere here at some point. For people who haven't seen much, oh, she has very particular style. So pieces are shot for galleries, essentially. Like, it's where it's going to be shown first. When you got that call, I think it was about 10 years ago, I guess, you shot the first short with her. And you know it's going to be mainly shown in a gallery. What goes through your mind? Is your approach different when you know that?
I approach everything the same way. I met Alex through a good friend of mine, one of my best friends at a gallery in New York, her gallery in New York, during one of her shows. I was stricken by how cinematic her work was. She just had an energy to what she was saying. And there was a feminist quality to it, and there was a cinematic quality to it. And little did I know that she wanted to make films, right? And I was literally, I met her briefly. And when an artist is at a show, you can't really, you know, talk their ear off. I met her briefly. Subsequently, maybe 6 months later, she asked if I would shoot a film called Despair. Mm-hmm. And that was her first foray into motion pictures. I jumped at the chance because here's the thing. As a cinematographer, we deal in visuals, and you probably have had this as well. But sometimes we feel like the visual can speak enough without the dialogue. When I met Alex, I could see that concept in the script. Perhaps it didn't make a fluid sense from what my experience had been previous to that. And she's the first artist that I ever shot or applied my craft to. And, it was a meeting in the middle, in a way. And it was a good exercise, not exercise, but it was a good experience in the sense of how do we turn this prose that we're used to poetry? Because that's how she is. I mean, she is more poetry than prose. And it's less literal. And she comes from an art world where her photographs exist for interpretation. And what I love about the art is it is up to interpretation. There's less onus on the fact that you have to communicate to the lowest common denominator. And there's something cool about that. And there's something that that's something that people should strive for to understand. I was really happy to make Despair. And then we went on to another film. We've done three, I believe, and the one that you referenced there, the very latest one. And it,
Play
the Wind, and it's evolved. It's completely evolved because she's in transition. She just has a world of references that an equality and a desire to sort of tell her life story through her images. No, maybe not her life story, that personal, but she's definitely, like, everything she's consumed as an artist,
it sort of
comes out in
parallel,
her work.
Parallel, yet not really parallel world.
I mean, you can't sit there. You can't sit there and say analyze her work as somebody who wants to be this person or that person. She's somebody who's actually being her own person, honestly putting it out there in the world. And now she's transitioning into storytelling. So that poetry may become prose eventually. But where she started, I think, was going to be very interesting to see in the future. And I wanted to be a part of that.
I love these pieces. And I've seen them in the gallery. And I it's interesting argument, I guess, as well, because I'm just showed like 17-second teaser on half of an iPhone screen.
Yeah.
But there's still that power in there. So sometimes I think, do we overthink? Should it be more mass accessible as an art, even when we make films? Should we be fine with the fact it's going to be shown on a small screen? Because in the end, it is about the impact. And where does the artist stop wanting it on a massive screen? And where does the, you know, impact still is there?
I think that we don't have a choice, to be honest with you, Edgar. We don't have a choice.
It's going smaller and smaller, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that it's cyclical. Everything is cyclical. And people will start to yearn. There's going to be an uprising once, hopefully there is a vaccine for this, and then we can gather again like normal people, and people can see things on a big screen. It's a thrill to see the work Alex and I have done together, even at the gallery during a show. And then seeing there's nothing like feeling the audience reaction. Even if you're not reading specific things, you're feeling an audience reaction to it. And we can't feel that from home. I have a very hard time watching films at home because I don't feel the reaction. And I hope we get to a place where we can actually do that again. And what her work does is, like, I've seen an evolution. Oddly, I've seen the same evolution in a person like Jon Favreau, you know, coming from one place and moving to another. And I've seen the same thing with Alex. It's like, I've seen this progression of her work. She's told me she's learned a lot from me, but I've learned a lot from her. I've become a better cinematographer because I could think outside of the practical minutia of how we tell stories in cinema.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, if there's any traits kind of in her style of work, or even day to day when she's on set, which you haven't seen before, because she's not a filmmaker director. She came from a very different angle. So she probably didn't copy certain moves or traits or thinkings of other filmmakers, which I guess can be a curse and a cur at the same time.
Well, which makes it all the more satisfying working with her, because it gets old, to be quite honest. I mean, I'm old. I've been here for a minute, and it's the same shit all over and over and over again. And when you meet somebody who brings something new to your life, that in a new perspective, and it's a sort of this meeting of two experiences into a creative center, I enjoy that collaboration because she's brought to me a different way of thinking, and maybe all I could bring is sort of a technical aspect of how the mundane nature of cinema could possibly be.
Bring it down to earth, yeah. But talking about that sort of same old you mentioned, is that something, how you choose your scripts these days as well? They have to be very interesting to you or director, or how do you avoid kind of being bored to death with the process?
You know, in at its base reality, I think I look for something that makes me do something I haven't done again. I've done before, and I don't really want to repeat myself. And I think it's very dangerous as a cinematographer to repeat yourself. I look back at the work of Ed Lochman. I look back at the work of Owen Roisman, and I see the diversity in which they shoot films. And I've always patterned myself after people like that, because I think that you don't want to repeat yourself. You want to tell different stories, maybe be in contact with different cultures, and perhaps from an entertainment standpoint, be in contact with different genres. And that brings something else out in you, or else it's over. It's really over. It's not about technology. It's about approach. It's about how do you convey a certain reality? What I love about today is that people are taking what used to be stereotypical genres like comedy and horror and placing them in a hybrid sense, because that's how we evolve. And
something like us, like, it's great.
Yeah,
as in that kind of merge.
Right. And then we do that, and we have to do that as cinematographers, or else what are we doing? We're going to get bored. I mean, it's a fantastic profession. It's a fantastic craft. But what's going to keep us going in the long term for a long time? And it can't just be about our livelihood. It has to be about something else.
True. I want to kind of go towards the last of the discussed projects, which is very different, I guess, to you as well. So Spike Lee directs Mike Tyson's stand-up, which happened 5 years ago, something along those lines. Can you talk through how did that come about and how much you were involved in it? Did you go see the shows on tour, or what's the way to do it?
I didn't really know what to expect when Spike asked me to do it, to be honest with you. I thought I would be setting up cameras that, to get every angle possible on him to make a show that could be recorded and excited. But what was interesting about it for me was him. Mike Tyson, like his story, like how to go out in on a stage and basically tell the story. Like, some people do that in interview, not a recorded live show. I'm sure people don't, who aren't boxing fans, might not be interested, but he was a pop cultural icon. My favorite quote from Mike Tyson was that everybody's got a plan to get punched until they get punched in the face. You know, and that if you take that and transpose that to a lot of different things metaphorically, well, that applies, right? Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And I remember how dominant he was when he first came out. So I wanted to be a part of it just because he was a cultural icon. You know, his life, everybody's life is checkered with things that they could regret. But his story had to be told, right? What was interesting from a technical standpoint is, like, I just basically worked off the lighting that was created in a previous show in Las Vegas. I was intrigued. I'm like, what could this possibly be? I had no idea what it was. And it wasn't really recorded. I didn't have the benefit of watching it, which is probably a good thing. And then we set up cameras in a theater, in a Broadway theater.
So you didn't like go see it in Las Vegas?
No, I had never seen it before.
Oh, wow, okay.
I mean, Spike was just explaining what it was.
Have you read, like, is there a way to read it? Or there was nothing? Like...
No.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, I didn't know. I knew I had heard about it and read articles about it and how some people loved it and some people didn't like it. And I just sort of got as much information as I could. But going into it, I didn't have a lot of information to make technical choices. But mm-hmm. we positioned cameras. I think it might have been at the Belasco Theater in New York. I'm not sure exactly. But it was a small Broadway theater in New York. And what became interesting, I didn't know how it was going to go down. Like, I thought maybe I'd be on a camera and then I'd have all the, you know. I was able to employ a lot of my friends in New York to be on cameras. And that was fun. And then I ended up being in a booth as a technical director, basically speaking to all my past collaborators who I put on different cameras. Just reframing people and talking to people. And then Spike would point at a screen and be like, that one. And I literally had the switcher myself and would switch live broadcast. I'd never done that before. But like having Spike over my shoulder, we're all watching three different screens with split screens and all these cameras. And watching this many, you know, working with him, you have to work very quickly and mm-hmm. your mind has to work mm-hmm. extremely fast. It was a good exercise in like trying to craft angles and possible cuts, and I would just try to provide him as many possible cuts as possible. So it was a microcosm of our normal cinematic process in a weird way.
And there is, it's really interesting. I was watching it a couple of days ago. There is kind of Spike and you in those images. And it's, I found them in those kind of zooms left in time to time. I really enjoyed the fact that zooms were in because it sort of adds that granule of spontaneity because you're sort of reframing but the zoom is in there,
yeah,
and yet you're not sure like what's the punchline, how the joke is gonna end. And he moves a lot as well. Eventually he starts to move all over the stage, plus the projection, this massive screen, for those who haven't seen, it's a massive right. screen behind him was, I guess, footage shot by you, because I think you referenced
I mean, it was just previous footage. It was all from the original show. Okay. I mean, I thought it was well put together. I'd never seen anything like that. It reminds me of Eric Bogosian or Lenny Bruce. He's not a comedian. He was literally telling his life story. It just feels like somebody who had been through the ringer of, if it was later in time, it would be a person explaining everything that had happened in social media. But it was everything that had happened within microscope of being in media.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was an interesting thing. And it's like, it should be, the idea and concept of it could be taught in communications schools.
Yeah. And also,
it's a predecessor, really, of the potential of social media.
It's true. And also, the fact that he's not a comedian, I think, is great because it's kind of very rough around the edges, some of the delivery, and he's trying to sort of time it at times. And I think it's a beautiful piece of kind of unexpected, beautiful piece of work in some sense. Are you happy with how it sort of turned out? Will you ever do a stand-up again?
I've done a couple with him. You know, Spike and I did Passing Strange, which is a play, the beautiful play. I wish I would have done, if I to do it again, I would love to light it differently and mm-hmm. use different cameras, to be honest with you, in both cases. And we also did a concert for Cat Williams where it was a live show. Mm-hmm. What I love about working with Spike is like he'll ask me to do something that has nothing to do with what we did last time. His trust in me will never go unrecognized. He lets me think outside of my usual existence.
Do you remember the very first call, I guess, you got from him? Do you remember that, receiving it, or the first day, actually, on set?
No, absolutely. I remember getting a call from my agent at the time saying that Spike Lee wants to meet you tomorrow. I think I went into a catatonic state where I actually don't remember that day, but I remember getting the call. And then meeting him, I really had to do everything in my power not to be a bit starstruck by the moment. If you're lucky as a cinematographer and you get to work with a hero, it's very important for you to just separate yourself, your past self, from your present self, and then work as a collaborator. And I learned that the hard way in many cases. Early on, I'd blown meetings completely because of my adoration for the person I was meeting. But I didn't want to blow that one. First time I met Spike Lee, it validated why I was so appreciative of his work, because it did speak to me when I was inspired by him and Ernest Dickerson, who I also worked with. Like, I was inspired by them, and meeting them and working with them validated why in every way, shape, and form.
And I guess you can easily blow it because they just want to be talked like normal people, right? I guess that's what you mean by blowing it. Like, how can the meeting go wrong, for example, for those who might?
Well, because you're talking about things that aren't important. You're talking about, like, maybe anecdotes don't have to do with your experience as a filmmaker. The anecdotes have to do with things that you've seen on TV with them. That's ridiculous. What you have to do is understand that they're there to meet a future collaborator. You're there to be their collaborator. Like, you have to step outside of what you know about them in a certain sense and listen like a person. Like, what are they saying at that moment? Forget what they said in the past.
Very good point. And working with Spike as well, you mentioned, I think, in the other interview, I think it was maybe to do with Chirac, actually. I feel there's a certain jazz to both of you, the way you work. There is some plan. And I think you mentioned Spike might have a plan. It's in a napkin in the morning, but then it sort of kind of goes. Is that the case, that there is certain kind of different tendency to work a bit more on improv of the day?
You talking about him specifically? Or
I would say your collaborations with him, yeah.
You know, sometimes it's planned and sometimes it's improvisational. Sometimes it's just discussed and not put on paper. I'll tell you one thing, it's not shared with production. You know, he's an auteur in the finest sense, where it's like he knows. Look, Spike has a responsibility to, and he takes it on very responsibly to make the day. He's not going to risk the budget because he's worked hard to get the money to make a film. He appreciates that, like an independent filmmaker to this day, that he appreciates what he has to accomplish on any given day, and he crafts it that way. When a director is taking that into account, the ask starts to fit the means that you have, whereas a majority of the time the ask doesn't fit the means and conflict ensues. So that comes from experience of being an indie filmmaker and just carrying that through as a philosophy for his whole career.
That's a very good point. So sort of stay on the day, but you can improvise as long as you kind of finish on time. Don't lose.
Well, you could also you could bar from this day to take to another day when you start to think about it. And it's like it's a concept that, you know, again, I learned this in working with Bradley Cooper on A Star Is Born, is that you're always thinking of how to make the film better. Spike Lee does the same thing. Darren Aronofsky's contemplating the screenplay. They're always there trying to make the film better. As cinematographers, we have to be ready for improvisation, or else we're not going to make the film better. Like, the storyboards, the shot lists, the schedule is not a motherfucking contract to production. This is the guideline that we're about to do. Well, guess what? We're going to change it right now, but we still are responsible to date the next day. You know, and that's important.
True. That's so true. Does it get easier with years?
I think it depends on who you are and what you're trying to do. If it starts to, parts of it get easier. But let me just say this. Some of the cinematography bits after the digital technology and the takeover of digital technology have become easier because we don't have the exposure anxiety that we did when we were exposing film. And we didn't have to wait the next day to see the image and hope it wasn't black or just underexposed or overexposed or our timing lights were way off. But if you're still creative, it opens you up to observe other things. And a lot of that has to do with how to help the director in terms of performance and tone and how to get inside a scene and outside of a scene. It gets easier in some respects, but then you take on more. So it's individual. It's an individual concept, whether or not it gets easier or not. If it gets easier, I think that you're not working hard enough. If it stays the same or gets harder, then you're still doing it.
That's true. Matthew, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, man. Good talk.
It's great. Thank you. And yeah, thank you, man. See you for a beer in London or LA anytime soon.
Yeah, or somewhere else.
Yeah, true. Thanks.
All right, stay in touch, man. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Good job.
Cheers.
I appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Cheers.
Ladies and gentlemen, Matthew Libatique. Next week, I'm going to talk to my camera crew. It's going to be an inside view, quite special episode for those thinking maybe going camera crew or just interested in how we think, how our department works. I'm going to speak to my first AC or focus puller in UK, Thomas Nicholson, and Stephanie Kennedy, who is the second AC. Going to talk travels, gear, health, bullying, and stepping up. So tune in next week. And once again, thank you so much for sharing the episode on socials. I really, really appreciate it. All right. See you next week. Bye-bye.